This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. Good morning, Rahul.
Good morning, Ben. Hey, I know we're not supposed to talk football, but I really feel like both of our teams are out of contention now, and that's probably for the first time in forever. And it's been a while for your team this season, but it probably just happened for mine. And now we can actually do real things.
I feel for you, though. I mean, the difference is that we had a dynasty for 20 years, and this is supposed to be your moment.
Well, thanks for that, Ben. I really appreciate
it. Not to rub it in or anything. But, you know, it's not easy to be a Buffalo Bills fan. I feel for you, Rahul.
I know. I think I'm going to die without a Super Bowl experience, but that's okay. My kids will be waiting for it.
That's good. They have something to look forward to.
So I want to introduce Doug Johnson and Neville Johnson. Thank you guys both for joining the podcast. Neville, I've known for, I feel like, 10, 15 years now. We've been on the CALA board together, which is the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles. And I've gotten to see a lot of his successes over the years. And Doug, it's great to meet you and have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
So I don't think we've had, Ben, have we had many entertainment and IP lawyers on the show?
I can't think of many other than the judge that we had, I think, early on. No, we haven't. I'm really interested to hear about that. When I was a baby lawyer at Latham & Watkins in my early days, I did a lot of IP litigation, but haven't been involved in it since. So, but I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, right before we started, I was telling Doug and Neville, I get starstruck. So every time I see a famous person on the road or anywhere else, I'm just trying to figure out how I can even get to talk to them. And it sounds like as part of your practice for all these years, you've just got famous people coming into your office on the daily. So tell us a little bit about your practice and how you got to be where you are.
I'm Neville, and I have been practicing for 4 decades, and that's all I ever wanted to do was entertainment law. And I started off just wanting to negotiate music contracts because I loved pop music and rock and roll. And that eventually morphed 4 or 5 years into litigation, doing litigation as well. And I'd say our practice is probably 85% litigation at this point, predominantly in the IP entertainment area. And also we have a practice in libel, defamation, invasion of privacy cases as well. So I started off as a solo, and now we're 8 lawyers in Beverly Hills, California.
Yeah. So for me, I was a young undergrad student at USC, and there was an ad in the political science department that said, if you think you want to be a lawyer, you could work 12 hours for this lawyer who's a music lawyer. And so I went and interviewed with a couple other people and ended up getting an internship with Neville way, way back, and carried around his briefcase. And at the time, he was doing all the Beatles stuff for Yoko Ono, and he had a lot of music clients. And so I thought that was exciting. I thought all lawyers did exciting things, and we stayed in touch with each other. And then I ended up working for his law firm as a clerk, summer clerk while I was in law school. Went to a medium-sized firm up in San Francisco and missed the entertainment side of work and music and movies and IP stuff. So I ended up back with his firm, and I guess the rest is history.
So what makes it exciting doing the entertainment side, starting when you were at USC and then kind of moving onward?
I think it's just a little more sexy than broken bones and dead bodies sometimes. I'm not sure there's too much to it. I mean, music and movies is all about telling stories, and you have a lot of creative people. And for me, I'm not so creative. I could barely draw a stick man. So I think I'm impressed with how they go about their craft and the way that they do it. And then I realized that they needed protecting. They're not the side of the brain that does the business stuff. And so I really saw the need to protect artists and help them in their business matters and the way that they handle things. They're really not interested, a lot of them, in the money. They're really interested in the craft and the creative outlet that it is. So I felt like I was really helping somebody. I feel like we're the rights. I mean, we just represent talent. So that's actors, writers, directors, producers, production companies, financiers, things like that. So I think it's probably same thing for consumer and personal injury lawyers. You know, you're helping somebody who really needs help. And the other side of the fence obviously has tons of lawyers in line waiting to represent a studio, and talent on the other side needs good representation. One of the things that we kind of have made a niche of or stood out from other firms is that we'll not represent studios or record labels. We won't do it unless they're independent record labels. But and that helps us get a lot of big clients, because the clients think that, you know, transactional lawyers or other lawyers, their clients are either pitching at a studio or trying to make other deals at a record label. And so they're kind of, there's an inherent conflict with entertainment lawyers, because they're trying to do business with the other side. Either they're transactional entertainment lawyers. And so what we do is we make sure that the talent knows we never work for the other side. And that gives them a big comfort level, because they're always kind of suspicious that people have conflicts. They're very used to it, in a sense. So I think that's why I think that there's just a group of people that need representation. And I feel like we're fighting the good fight, or wearing the white hat, or whatever you want to call that.
I would jump in and say that our competitors, a lot of times, they won't sue the studios because they want to represent the studios, A, or B, they want to pitch to them, try and get them into productions or deals, and C, a lot of the times we're working on a contingency basis and they don't want to do that as well. So there's very, very few companies that have the sophistication, interest, experience, financial capability take on these monolithic studios, which are going to be represented by big law invariably.
Hey, Neville, you mentioned that when you were just starting out, you were attracted to this because you were into pop and rock. So I'm curious, what were the artists at that era that drew you in? And are you still also a fan? And if so, of what today?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was a huge fan of the Beatles, and I was fortunate enough 5 years into my practice to get Yoko Ono and the estate of John Lennon as a client. That's all I did for several years was Beatles, Beatles, Beatles.
And how did you go about doing that? That must have been quite a coup.
Somebody recommended me, and Yoko wanted a lawyer on the West Coast for whatever reason, and I had an expertise in international copyright law, and that's so I did it. And I was also a huge fan of Buddy Holly, and I became the lawyer for the estate of Buddy Holly. And also Rick Nelson I was a fan of. And so I've been fortunate to represent a lot of my heroes over time. And am I still a fan? Yeah, but not, I mean, I can't, okay, I'll admit it, I'm no expert on hip hop, but I like Taylor Swift, I like contemporary pop music, and I might as well mention it now. I have been leading a band for the last 30 years. I have released a number of albums. I have a manager and a publicist. I sold out my last four concerts, and I perform under the name Trevor McShane, and I write and sing and play guitar in a 12-piece band while we perform. So I'm into it.
So you doing original stuff or covers?
Oh, yeah, it's all original. Uh-huh. And I'm writing with a number of great writers as well, people who've had hits. So for the first time, I'm legitimately trying to get some attention. Before, I never promoted it really because I didn't want it to take away from my practice and have people think I wasn't serious.
How many members of your band?
when we perform now, we're 12 people, and I have a four-piece horn section. Every one of my musicians is a pro. My trumpet player backed the Stones on tour, was in the Jay Giles band. My guitar player's written 400 books on how to play guitar. And that's the kind of quality. It's a thrill for me. I'm an amateur compared to them.
Can you guys just talk a little bit about what you've seen in terms of changes over time in the industry? It must be pretty fascinating to track from the days of radio play and cassette tapes to the digital streaming and everything that's going on today. And how has that impacted your legal practice?
Every time there's a technological change, the creators are being taken advantage of. The people who own the studios or record companies try and figure out a way how to squeeze the talent. So when it went from vinyl to cassettes and then cassettes to CDs and then into streaming, et cetera, but downloads and then streaming, each time you saw a way in which a class action could be created, and we were involved in some of those. So for example, in the download situation, they tried to pay download royalties on the same level as record royalties. And the argument was made that, excuse me, this is a licensing situation as opposed to a traditional sales situation, and the royalties should be double. So we brought three class actions and settled them favorably for talent. And then more recently, we're involved in streaming cases where, get this, the record companies, it's 95% of all the money coming in right now is streaming. So the record companies have this category called intercompany charge, where before the money comes to America outside the United States, they take a huge chunk. In one case, it was 68% of the income and didn't tell the artist before they repatriated the money to America. So we sued one company and settled on that. And we've got two cases pending right now, class actions, one in Nashville and one in Los Angeles, in which you can't do that overall. And the same thing happens in the motion picture industry when it, for example, video cassettes, et cetera, and what are the royalties that would be payable on that? There's been class actions that we ended up bringing against all of the studios saying you are underpaying talent pre-1981 movies, et cetera, because you never had it in your contracts that you could pay them this lesser standard overall. So we're on the lookout for that all the time. And I'll just mention one other area. There's something called foreign levies. The countries of outside the United States have national laws that provide for royalties for writers, directors, and actors. And for a period of 10, 12 years, the unions, SAG, Screen Actors Guild, Directors Guild, Writers Guild, were collecting these monies and not paying them out to their members. So when I sued the Writers Guild, they had like $50 million that they hadn't paid out for 10 years. I said, why haven't you paid these people? And they said, well, it's tough. Well, that's not a good excuse. So we ended up fighting with them for a number of years on class actions and ultimately settled. And now today, I'd say $400 or $500 million we've gotten paid out to the talent overall. So somebody needs to be on watching these people, the monitoring them overall. And getting back to your question, it's the technology and new forms of income, and you have to closely monitor that.
What's your guys' take on the Ed Sheeran and Marvin Gaye case? Do you have an opinion about that? Or first of all, were you guys involved in that at all?
No, we weren't. But that case is the trend of where the court's been going, at least the Ninth Circuit, in allowing the musicians to use other riffs and use basic building blocks in music. There was a big push and pull in the beginning. Marvin Gaye and Robert Thicke and Pharrell, they had a big lawsuit and they lost. And they admitted that they were inspired by Marvin Gaye, and Thicke went around in public and I think sunk himself by giving interviews saying we were vibing them, we were using them, and just kind of went over the board about how much they were really trying to be influenced by him. And then the courts started realizing with Led Zeppelin case, then the Katy Perry case, and started to give musicians. So then Sheeran's case came and the court was going there anyways, that a lot of these basic building blocks, artists need them to make the music that they're making. All artists use basic building blocks. And so the key is to try not to monopolize those building blocks. Otherwise, you stifle art and new art. And so I think that was a good decision and the right decision. And the jury heard him play on the stand and got to see how he actually writes music. And so he stood up for himself. You know, he's been involved in lawsuits before and settled them. And he finally pretty much had it. And I know he missed his grandmother's funeral over it, just to make sure that he won that case.
But don't get me wrong. It happens all the time. There is a lot of theft in the entertainment industry. We see it not only in music, but in plagiarism in most pictures and television. And we have a big practice in what are called theft of idea cases, where you go and you pitch a producer on a television show or idea, and they rip you off. And it doesn't rise to the level of copyright infringement, but under the theory of implied contract, and we have a very developed law in California, you can go after the person who took your idea. And it happens because the lingua franca, the currency of Hollywood, is ideas. And if you're an executive and you don't have a good idea every year or two, you're going to get fired.
Going back to your earlier question, I do want to say, I think people don't realize this, but technology moves so fast, the law can't keep up with it at all. So copyright law is being strained all the time to try to figure out, or even new technology pushes the old contracts. For instance, in music, those old music contracts for what we call legacy artists, they were bad news, and they didn't pay them very much money at all. And the record companies had a lot of costs back then. They'd have to make the album and press them and ship them and own a retail store, and they'd have breakage and all this stuff. So their contracts were set up to pay the artist 5 cents a record, 10 cents a record. And what happened is that digital, first they had downloads, which download is a license of music to Apple. So all of those contracts should have been paying the artist at 50%. And then music companies, no, it's a sale of a record. We want to keep paying these people a nickel a record. Literally, with a straight face, they make these arguments. And so the same thing happened when streaming came in for music. They continually, now they have really no cost at all, just hitting a button over to Spotify and music's digitally transferred. They're not shipping it. They're not pressing records or CDs. What they're trying to do, and the movie companies do the same thing with the new technology, they're trying to keep their old models, which had a ton of costs built in for the either studio side or record label side. And they're continually trying to put the new technologies in to these old contracts that never envisioned that things would be so simple and cost the record companies or movie companies really little to none. And so we've brought in now 3 or 4 different types of class actions in those areas and got them to cough up money. But the new one now is that studios want to only pay. And there's a little secret in Hollywood that home video, you know, back in the day with the cassettes, they would only pay a 20% royalty. And so now they're trying to say streaming is home video. And so we only want to pay you 20%. I mean, it's kind of outrageous. You know, the artist should be sharing in the ease of giving the viewers or the listeners what they have. It's all digital. There's not a lot of costs involved at all. And everything should be at the very least 50-50 in our opinion. And so this is a constant struggle where the studios and record labels always trying to use the old model. And we're telling them, no, those contracts don't make any sense at all because we're in a different world. So the short answer to the question is we deal with it all the time. And the law is nowhere near up to where technology is.
On that, if I go on to Apple Music right now and I play a Trevor McShane song, Neville, are you better off with me playing it off of Apple Music or downloading the album and buying it or something else?
Nobody downloads anymore. That came and left. You know, the other biggest change in the business that has occurred for film and TV is the end of net profits or profit participations overall. So this is all because of Netflix and Amazon. When in the deals that they were making, they said, here's what's happening. We're going to pay you X amount of money to produce this, and there's going to be a certain amount of profit built in. And then we're going to say, this is your profit. But the notion before, which was that the people who were making productions as actors, writers, directors, producers, is that they would share in the revenue if the film or television show was a success. Well, Apple said, we're not going to let you know if it's a success or not. It's take it or leave it. That's the way it is. Well, guess what happened? Every other studio has gone the same way and has said, there's no more net profits anymore. And you're just going to get paid this amount of money. And that's all people have been talking about the last 5 years is how do we get around this? It works if you have a turkey, okay? But if you have a successful hit show, you're just not going to share in the revenue anymore. So the recent strike in Hollywood changed that to some degree in that there are now bonuses or payments that are paid to writers, actors, directors if there are successful shows, but they won't tell you. There's no transparency. You just have to trust them that you're getting paid on that level overall. So that's been a significant sea change in compensation.
Yeah, there's a lot of ancillary money that comes from a movie, say theme park ride, restaurants, all of this stuff. And what they wanted to do was take what we call the home run off the table. They want to keep all the home runs for themselves and just say, here's what you get up front, or here's a little bonus if you get a certain amount of viewers. But all this big, big money, the home run money that's lucrative for your lifetime and your kids and your grandchildren, that's gone. There's no more of that.
But I will say, if you're a major star and you're getting paid $20 million, it's not that big a hit for you, arguably, overall. And that's because of technology. This is what has happened. And we're seeing a shakeout in the sense that another thing that's happened is that, if you can believe it, of all the streamers, only Netflix is in profits. They're going to get into profits overall, but they overexpanded. They went to from 200 productions a year and TV shows to 500. Well, it's not sustainable.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. I got a question about this format we're doing right now, the podcast. It seems like it's proliferated a lot. Many celebrities have their own podcasts. Have you been involved at all in that, this medium, and understand how it's monetized and what the future holds for this type of thing? Not that we're going in that direction, right? Anytime fast, but for the successful celebrity podcasts out there, the Joe Rogans, you know, those type of things. What do you know anything about that stuff?
Well, I mean, we do, because we represent a lot of producers. We do see that it is a medium that can be used to pitch ideas to see how they are received. So a lot of filmmakers or people are using it in that sense. They want to get the idea out and they do like a mini series of some story, and then all of a sudden you'll see it on TV or you'll see it in a movie. And I think it's worked very well for that. It's a cheaper way to get out a story or an idea and see how well received it is and whether it's worth making something bigger out of it. On the flip side of that, I'm sure you guys are well aware that people went nuts and spent way too much money, whether it be Spotify or some of these big companies that spend a ton of money signing these artists and paying them a ton of money to have a podcast. And they've had to get out of a lot of those contracts, and they're writing down a huge losses because it wasn't as big of an area as they thought it was going to be. So that's happening now. And I think it'll come back to reality in some sense. I think a lot of companies overspent a bunch, just like they did in streaming. And so a lot of it's just kind of coming back. But I think people like it. I think it's a great way to listen to something in your car or while you're doing a walk. Or I think you can access more stories and more information easier and quicker. And so I think it will be something that sticks around for sure.
It's shaking out. It's a nascent industry at this point right now, but it's not going away. It's very, very, very important. But a good example is Meghan Markle. That thing did not do well. She lasted a year or so. And you'll see a lot of these people coming and going overall. but there are regular broadcasts. And look, it's wonderful what's happened. Anytime, anywhere, you can hear an interesting podcast. It's the same thing with streaming overall. You can hear any music, anytime, anywhere in the world. I mean, come on. I mean, how amazing is it that we don't have record stores anymore? We don't have bookstores anymore, thanks to Amazon, et cetera, and Kindle and all the rest of that. The one constant in life you hear is change. And that's what we're doing. So that's why our business is interesting, because we're always surfing the latest, newest wave of entertainment.
So just somebody who's totally outside the industry, Neville, I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan too. So relatively speaking, I don't have any understanding as to how the entertainment industry works. With the departure of music stores and bookstores, is there more opportunity for talent today with technology versus 20 years ago, or less opportunity?
Well, in music, absolutely. And I'll tell you why, because traditionally, at one point, there were 8-12 major music companies. And then that ultimately went down to about 4. And now there's 3. There's Universal Group and Warner Brothers, and one other one. And you couldn't get into the record store unless you were with one of these, which had 80% of the market. And then if you were on an indie label, the problem there was getting paid, because the indie labels were notorious for stiffing talent overall. Now anybody, anytime, anywhere can put up product. The problem is that you are swimming against millions of other people. You know, hundreds of thousands of new tracks are released every single day. And so it also changed how people are become popular overall. The new medium has been social media. Taylor Swift broke on MySpace initially. Remember MySpace?
Yeah.
And did a great job of doing it. She really figured out how to get the public behind her. But if you're the major labels now are not signing acts unless they have a substantial social following. And then to sign the acts, to promote them, they have to put in millions of dollars. It's still a payola world to get on the radio, which is the dirty little secret of contemporary popular music, is the money you have to spend, and how it all gets spent is sort of mysterious overall. But very few acts are going to get signed. And so that leaves the rest of the world to go out and fight to get seen. But if you look on the charts right now, you'll see virtually no indie acts whatsoever on the Billboard Top 100. But still, people can make a good living. You know, a guy like Jackson Browne is a good example. The guy puts out his own records. He sells plenty. I mean, I know about, because I know the people involved in his career. He's done it just fine. He's figured it out how to do it overall. That what they're saying now is that the streaming royalties are so poor that the only way a musician can make money is off of touring and merchandising overall. And that's a sad commentary, and that's something that we hope will change over time, is a more equitable division of the royalties overall, as Doug pointed out. You know, no more manufacturing and distribution costs. Yeah, well, how come the royalties have stayed so low overall?
Can you guys tell us about some of your more interesting or significant cases?
Let's see. The case that sort of put me on the map was a case where I sued the ABC Television Network for invasion of privacy on the use of hidden cameras on a investigative journalism show called Primetime Live, where they went in and they secretly taped with a false employee where my clients were tarot card readers, basically on the 900 number. And they basically said, you know, you shouldn't trust tarot card readers, which is like, oh, really? That's genius there. They had no right to go in and do that. I sued them for invasion of privacy. I got the first verdict in the history of the United States for more than $1 for this kind of investigative journalism, and the first verdict in the history of the United States for punitive damages. It went to the Court of Appeal, where I lost 2-1, and then we appealed to the California Supreme Court, during the course of which I learned that the opposing counsel had cheated and put in false evidence in the California Court of Appeal that I had never seen or known about, in which they changed the evidentiary supplement that had nothing to do with the case overall, but made their case look good. Bottom line is that I helped establish the boundaries of journalism in the United States of America. It went It was a published decision. It studied in three law schools across America. And it was little old me, basically a solo practitioner against massive, nasty ABC and their cheating lawyers overall. So that's a case called Sanders. And that was obviously very interesting to do, but it was backbreaking.
It's actually in case books across the country, not just three law schools. I don't know where that comes in. Almost every law school teaches the case as how to learn the tort of right of privacy. But another case that we did that was really significant is we sued all of the studios for actors that had back end when home DVD came in. So most contracts in the movie business said that the participants got a percentage of the gross revenue that came in, whether they got 10%, 20%, whatever it is. And the studios on their own decided that home video, in the beginning of home video, it was like beta and then home video, they didn't think it was going to be anything at all. And so they let third parties kind of do it. And they had just gotten paid 20% themselves from these third party vendors. And then the studios realized that it was a cash cow. They took it in house and then they charged all of the artists just a 20% royalty and kept basically all the money. And we were representing Richard Dreyfuss on an audit. We do tons of audits. We go in, the auditor does the audit and comes back and says, hey, they're misaccounting on all these issues here. Well, he was so upset about it. He said, we got to make class actions. We got to fix all of this for everybody. And so ultimately we did one against every studio and they owed 100% gross receipts per the contract and they were just paying 20%. And so those were big cases and those helped out a lot of artists who didn't even know that they were entitled to so much more money. And we did the same thing in the record business. We talked about those cases where downloads came into play and we sued all of the labels for major acts and got more payments to them. Downloads were supposed to be paid at 50%. They were paying like 5%. So that's one of those technology shifts. We've done a lot of big back-end cases. And I think some of the biggest ones we did for Sly, for Sylvester Stallone. And one of them was significant against Warner Brothers, where we got a fraud ruling, at least in the early on in the case, which is very difficult in a contract dispute. Usually it's the economic loss rule. And there, though, the studio had literally been paying other participants. And the way that the business works is if one back-end participant comes in and finds out that they're owed a bunch of money, nobody else knows. The auditors sign agreements saying you can't tell anybody else. So they just fix it for one guy. Well, other people were in profits and they were telling Sly that he was millions and millions of dollars in the hole, which was just completely wrong. And so that was a pretty significant case. And we got our complaint moved through the courts with a fraud. They had told him that his property was so far underwater that they wouldn't even send him statements anymore. Well, for 15, 20 years, he was in profits and they had never said a word to him. And we have had a lot of cases like that for big movie properties where we've gone in and found a lot of what studio would call accounting errors, but they're the same accounting errors that basically happen almost every time.
My favorite anecdote is the one company where we had a representative, an executive and a producer. And why haven't you paid our client the millions of dollars he's owed? And the answer is, we forgot.
Yeah.
A more recent case that we've done that's we've settled that we've had that's been hard fought that is suing the Screen Actors Guild because several years ago they told 15,000 actors over the age of 65, you don't have health insurance anymore, even though we promised you that you had lifetime health insurance because we're running out of money overall. And I was getting phone calls from across the nation saying, I'm scared to go out of the house. How could this happen? For their supplemental Medicare monies, it was. So we sued for breach of fiduciary duty against the health fund overall and the trustees saying, how could you let this happen overall? You have totally mismanaged this. And they fought us all the way up to pass summary judgment to the moment of truth, and we just settled that case and got these people basically made, if not fully whole, substantially whole overall. But that's a great reason why, for example, class actions help. None of these people that we've represented who are profit participants or, in this case, who are entitled to this health care would have ever brought a case individually, 15,000, 20,000, 30,000, whatever it may be. So we've helped thousands and thousands of musicians and talent and actors, et cetera, by being able to do these class actions overall. And it's been, I'd like to say that we pioneered doing class actions for talent in the entertainment industry. And it's been really thrilling. And I can tell my grandchildren or whomever that look what we were able to accomplish overall. I mean, justice occurred in these cases.
Another big recent case we did about 2-3 years ago down in San Diego was we represented the Hanson Juice family. I don't know if you guys remember Hanson Sodas and Hanson Juice.
Yeah.
Well, Monster bought them and bought the trademarks and the business. And it was Hanson before it was Monster. It was Hanson Beverage. And then they came up with a Monster drink. Well, and then Hanson then sold, it's called Hubert's Lemonade. Well, Hubert Hanson was the founder of Hanson Juice. And they decided that they would make a lemonade called Hubert's Lemonade. And on the back was a whole story about Hubert Hanson, how he had come to Hollywood and was the first guy to sell juice way back in the day before anybody made juice, and would sell it to all the stars. And they showed him in his truck, like a little drawing of him. And so we sued for right of publicity and your name and your likeness. And it was the largest verdict in the United States. Michael Jordan had it for $9 million. I think ours was $10 million, and then another 10 or so in fees. But we do a lot of right of publicity. It's a common case in our office to represent models and actors and sports stars whose images are used on advertisement. It's not as prevalent as it was before. I think companies found images fungible and they just find them online. But still, there's a lot of work. And California has a very stringent statute that allows you to get profits, punitive damages, emotional damages, actual damages. So we have 5 or 8 of those cases going on at all time.
I would imagine that the challenges of representing talent, some of whom could be considered celebrities and some maybe aren't quite at that level, but they're still talented individuals, brings with it difficulties that are beyond what lawyers like Rahul and I that don't represent, you know, so-called talent, because at least for us that are pop culture, you learn that people with talent have egos and are very demanding and very idiosyncratic in ways that can be difficult. Do you find that? And if so, how do you manage clients in that setting?
Well, I'll take that. I'll just say that most of the clients we get are pretty reasonable, but I'm sure just as in your business, your area of practice as well, you get clients who have outsized notions of what their worth is and recovery overall. And so we've been cautious to never tell anybody that, oh, you're got such a big winner here, you're going to hit it out of the park. Overall, I mean, it depends on the judge you get. It depends on where you are in the jury, contemporary times, et cetera. So I would say that most of the time we get along pretty well. Sometimes we just have clients like you have who are just plain difficult. And you know what? You really shouldn't be a client of ours in that particular case. So we've seen a few who've left our practice and we may take a lien on the particular case. But generally speaking, they listen to us. Look, we're the experts and we get pitched cases every day. We don't take them unless they're going to pay off at the end of the day in the long run. And they may not pay off because they're not lucrative enough, or they just have facts that are not attractive. Taking on a case, as you well know, is an expensive proposition whether you're working contingency or hourly overall. And so, for example, if you've got a defamation case, and we do have 2 cases, one just settled, where the client is paying hourly, one we're defending and one we were prosecuting, and you're well into 6 figures, and they're going to go to potentially to 7 if they go all the way overall. So you better have a client who understands what's going on, and you better have pretty good facts on your case for whatever you're doing overall. But bottom line is that we get along pretty well with most of our clients.
So changing topics, and I don't even know if this is a question that you guys are comfortable talking about, but I don't understand masters. So these master recordings, and I'm just still thinking about this Taylor Swift scenario where she sold all her masters and then she re-recorded them. What the heck is a master? And then what does that mean? And then how could she do that?
A master is the recording itself. In the business that we're in, every record company owns the masters ordinarily. That's traditionally how it's been. So she became such a big pop star that when she was in a smaller production company that owned the masters, that when that company decided to sell them for, I think it was about $300 million or something at that time, supposedly she was not offered the ability to buy them, and that really antagonized her overall. They didn't have a legal obligation to offer it. Did they have a moral obligation? Well, that's debatable as well, but she was so incensed that she's gone out and re-recorded all of her albums, which is actually a brilliant move. That means she's owning all of these new masters, and they've been big hits overall, although the old masters are still making money. She was antagonized because Scooter Braun had bought the masters, and she detested him because he represented Kanye West, who made that decision, the decision he made on the award show. He came up and tried to take the thing away. And how about having the President of the United States saying you're a jackass? I mean, that's what Obama said at the time. It's still incredible. In any event, now all the record companies are saying you may not re-record your masters ever whatsoever. That's a anti-Taylor Swift situation overall. And one other interesting thing I read about on the Scooter Braun situation was he paid $300 and then he flipped it like a year later to a hedge fund for like $420. He did all right.
Yeah, just so to answer that question, the first one you asked, the master, and then you have the publishing. So the master recording is the sound that's captured, the musical singing and the instruments and all of that. And then the publishing are the people who write the music, the notes and the lyrics. And so they're completely two different things. That's the difference.
There does seem to be a trend of artists selling their whole portfolios.
Oh, yeah.
I know Bruce Springsteen did that, and I think Genesis or...
We were involved in that early on. We had a client who figured that out, that, you know, these are little oil wells spouting off money, and you may not own the master, but how about the royalty stream? And in the case of Dylan, it's $500 million, et cetera, and Springsteen and all the rest of that, and on and on and on. So if you're an artist and you're in your 70s, yeah, it's going to continue to make a lot of money, but realistically, how much longer are you going to be around? And why shouldn't I settle this up, take as much as I can get right now, set it up for my estate and all the rest of that? So a whole new industry has buying up the royalty streams of recording artists and songwriters, et cetera. And it's actually quite brilliant. Although more recently, there's a company in Britain that has been involved in this, and they're going through substantial financial difficulties right now as to whether or not they're going to be able, where they're going with this. In other words, they're overspent. But there's 20 players in the business right now.
Yeah, and I'll say this. Yeah, of course, the amount of money that was being paid to these artists, from Smokey Robinson to Neil Young, they all were going, of course I'm going to say, you're going to give me that kind of money? And 20 times what your royalty stream is. And so it became an arms race from these hedge funds who had a ton of money, and they overpaid a lot. And so a lot of people are now out of the game, not doing it anymore, not paying that kind of money. But the people knew that it was a sweet spot. It's like a hot real estate market. And so a lot of them did sell, and they want the money now. Otherwise, it's going to be going to five generations or their royalties, and they won't get in on that. But I'm not sure that it's sustainable, the amount of money that has been paid for these catalogs. And so a lot of people are kind of shying away from that. But yeah, it's been a really big deal. And a lot of money has been doled out by companies to buy these.
It's called recurring income.
Yeah.
So here's a question for you. Probably we have a lot of listeners that are newer lawyers or even law students that are thinking, boy, these guys, their career, Neville and Doug, sounds really fun, really cool. I'd love to get into this type of law. So if you're just getting started right now, or maybe a few years into your career, and this is something you're interested in, what would you recommend that newer lawyers do to learn more about this kind of practice?
Copyright law. Understand the fundamentals of it, the right of publicity issues as well, and libel, defamation, things like that. invasion of privacy, contract law. You got to know cold. And if you can develop an expertise as well on internationally, because it's all interrelated right now. But I'd say the fundamental and most important thing is you just love. Somebody asked me, should I become an actor? And I said, the people in my experience who become actors or musicians do so because they have no other choice. It's so difficult to become successful in that field. Well, in any field you're going to go into, if you want to be an entertainment lawyer, A, you got to love the law, and B, you better love the particular area you're going to go into in the first place. So people that do sports law, they're fanatics about sports, et cetera. And we, Doug and I mean, I've always, my major, if I could say, in university was pop culture. That's what I loved, and I've still kept on top of it as best I can ever since. So it's learning the fundamentals and the basics overall, and then getting in with a shop or place or company that is going to allow you to develop and hone those skills.
I would say there's certain bar associations like Beverly Hills Bar that put on a ton of entertainment and IP programs, and students and young lawyers can be on those now on Zoom. Everything's opened up with that, and they can follow all of these trends and see who the lawyers are. And now they have, in-person meetings. We write an article for the New York entertainment section, and like New York and California have associations and bars and copyright societies, things like that, that you can get involved in that are really inside baseball, and you really meet the lawyers that are doing this kind of work. So you just have to kind of get involved into that world. And there's, like I said, a couple bar associations that have a lot of what they do is entertainment and IP.
Yeah, I'll mention that for the BHBA, Beverly Hills, a lot of these seminars go up free on YouTube.
One last question. How did you pick the name Trevor McShane?
My forefathers in about 1840 or so, as I understand, came over from Ireland, and they were McShanes. And they changed their name from McShane to Johnson. Mick is son, and Shane is John, because of prejudice against the Irish in Massachusetts. So it was a tribute to my forefathers. And the Trevor I picked because there were a lot of British actors named Trevor, and it sounded good.
I love it.
We're not related. He's not a real Johnson. I'm a real Swedish Johnson. He's not.
Well, thanks so much, guys. I'm going to be checking out Trevor McShane. I hope everybody else will, too. Well, where should people send their reviews?
Well, I don't know. I've got a website. I've got videos that are up, and you can check them out. And I think you might be pleasantly surprised overall. I wanted to say one other thing. You were talking about work-life balance. Hey,
yeah.
Who says all I can ever do in my life is be a lawyer? And one of the other things I'm proud of doing is I wrote the authorized biography of John Wooden of UCLA and his philosophy of success. And I started a book company with my wife as a result. And I really enjoyed that as well. And what I tell law students and everybody else is how important it is to have a life beyond, don't kill yourself being a lawyer all the time. Stop and smell the roses overall. What Wooden says about if you want to be a success is that success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction, knowing you've done your best to become your best. The key ingredients being enthusiasm, hard work, and going after a great and difficult challenge. And who was John Wooden? He was the greatest coach in the history of athletics in America. He won the national championship in basketball 10 out of 12 years, I submit.
Yeah, that sounds like a great read. I'm going to pick that up. Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you guys so much for joining us. This was really fascinating.
We really appreciate you.
Well, we were excited and pleased and honored to be able to participate. Thank you. And Rahul, who I know is, oh my God, what a giant killer.
Yeah.
Now, but let's talk about that. Let's just spend the whole day and talk about the Las Vegas case, okay?
No, thanks so much, guys. And looking forward to seeing you both soon.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Okay. Appreciate it.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.